This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The lives of six people wrongly sent to prison, including one who faced death row, are now the focus of a brand new opera opening at Cincinnati Opera. Blind Injustice tells the stories of how these people were exonerated thanks to the work of Ohio Innocence Project, based at the University of Cincinnati. And joining Cincinnati Edition today are Ohio Innocence Project Director and UC Law Professor Mark Godsey. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
And two of the people now free from incarcerations and whose lives are depicted in the new opera. Larice Glover is one of three men convicted of a murder in 1995, only to have that conviction thrown out in 2015. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Larice.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Ricky Jackson spent 39 years in prison, setting a U.S. record for the longest served sentence by a person who was later exonerated. He also joins us on the phone. Ricky, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon, Mike.
Our phone lines are tied up for this.
How you guys
Here's some greetings to you. I know they're big fans of yours as well, Mike.
Yeah, we're all good friends these days.
Our phone lines are tied up with our guest for this segment, but we do welcome your comments and questions via email, talk@wvxu.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Ricky, I'd like to start with you because the longest imprisonment leading to exoneration is not a record someone looks to set. And you spent your entire adulthood up until now behind bars. So I'm curious, Ricky, what is life like for you now?
Quite honestly, it's great. You know, it's good. It's good. I'm in a good place right now. Moving forward. And since I got out, you know, life has really been good, honestly. You know?
How did you adjust back on the free side of things?
Well, that's just it. I'm constantly adjusting, you know, after having spent so much time behind bars, you know, and pretty much watching the world go by through a fishbowl, you know, it's a constant adjustment, you know. It's constantly you have to remind yourself that, this is a whole new era. Things have changed. People, attitudes have changed. Politics have changed. A lot of things have changed. And you find yourself constantly having to remind yourself about that.
I'm wondering how you're able to find peace with a world that locked you up for so long on a charge that wasn't accurate.
Well, for me personally, it was a simple choice to make. You know, I lived in so much anguish and not at peace for all those years that, you know, having this great opportunity to finally, you know, be at peace and to make reckoning with my situation, you know, that's the way I wanted to live, you know. Not so much as forget my past, but not let my past define me.
I want to talk about the crime that you were accused of. You were profiled in the Smithsonian Magazine, and here's an excerpt from that article that appeared in the Smithsonian. Quote, "At 18, he enlisted in the Marines, hoping to make a career of it, but within a year, he was granted an honorable discharge for a bulky back. Soon after returning home, he and two friends were arrested for killing Harold Franks outside a neighborhood convenience store. Franks was doing business there. He sold money orders when, according to police, a pair of assailants splashed acid on his face, clubbed him, shot him several times, stole about $425, and fled. The story goes on to say police never found the murder weapon, and Ricky Jackson and his friends, the brothers Wiley and Ronnie Bridgman, insisted they were elsewhere at the time of the shooting and had never laid eyes on Franks, but detectives had obtained a statement from a local paperboy, 12-year-old Eddie Vernon, who knew the Bridgmans and Jackson. Eddie told police that Jackson fired the handgun, Ronnie Bridgman doused the victim with acid, and his brother drove the getaway car. Though Eddie was a shaky witness, he failed to identify the suspects in a police lineup, and several of his classmates testified he had not been near the crime scene. Three separate juries accepted the youngster's account, and in 1975, Jackson and the Bridgmans were convicted of murder and sentenced to die by electric chair. Ricky, why do you think investigators didn't believe you?
The further along they got into their investigation, I think it was obvious, you know, that at least, you know, suspicious that we might not be the guys. You know, it was just too many things that were pointing in all different directions besides us.
So you think that the investigators were really just looking to close this case and to find a conviction?
They wanted to close the case. I mean, they had several other options besides us. They had people with criminal records with the same type of MO in their files. You know, we had different cars, you know, different eyewitnesses account, but they had us right there, you know, given to them pretty much on a silver platter, and that's the option they chose to pursue. They had this young witness who was vulnerable, who was subject to prone to telling lies, you know, easy, persuaded, and that's, they used this kid. They turned him into a professional witness, pretty much.
And being accused is one thing. You would think that the justice system would play out and that you would have been let go, but being convicted is a completely other thing. So I'm wondering what your thoughts were when you were found guilty and sentenced to death.
By the time we had actually been indicted and was in the process of going to trial, I knew pretty much right then and there that our fate was sealed, because, I mean, the evidence against us was so ridiculous that it never should have gotten that far to begin with. You know, it never shouldn't have gotten that far. But once it did get that far, I mean, to me, it was a far-drawn conclusion that we were going to be convicted. I mean, the deck was just too heavily stacked against us.
Do you think about your 18-year-old self and who that person was?
You know, I never really got to know that guy, you know? I'm sorry, but... God, you kind of touched the nerve there, but... I never really got to know that guy, you know, because that guy had to become somebody else, you know.
We'll come back for more in just a moment, Ricky. Larice, you're one third of what became known as the East Cleveland Three, and you spent nearly 20 years in prison, convicted of a murder you did not commit. And now that you're free, what is life like for you now?
It's basically been a process. Trying to get back used to being free and adjusting to how life is out here. So, I mean, each day I just try to be a better person.
And here are some details about the murder that you were convicted of, Larice. It was 1995. 19-year-old Clifton Hudson Jr. was shot multiple times, and you and two others, Derek Wheat and Eugene Johnson, were charged based on the testimony of a 14-year-old girl. She later recanted that testimony about 9 years later, and the investigating officers were accused of coercing it out of her in the first place, and the new information previously withheld at trial ultimately led to your release. I want to know, Larice, when you were convicted at that moment, what were your feelings?
I think at the time of the conviction, I was still in disbelief, and I just felt like the system had failed us. Like, I couldn't understand like how we went from being a witness to a murder to actually being a suspect and later on convicted for the murder.
So you never really saw this as a possibility. We heard from Ricky there where he knew as soon as they were indicted that it was likely headed to a conviction at trial. Did you remain hopeful throughout the process that the jury would come back favorably for you?
Yes, I honestly did, because, you know, I had never been in any trouble before, and I never thought that the judicial system would get it wrong. I thought that they would get it right. So even though we was arrested and charged with it, I thought that they would eventually get it right. And they did.
Did you have feelings similar to what Ricky explained to us, that there may have been clues that you were not responsible for this, but the investigators were hungry for some type of conviction to close the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, well, in our case, there was a lot of stuff that was withheld. So a lot of stuff we didn't find out until probably 8 months before we was released, because we had finally got the police report, which they would have been withheld for us through our whole time being incarcerated. So once we got the police report, it pointed in the direction of several different ways that they could have went upon this, and they didn't do that. Like, they were just so focused because somebody said they seen the truck speed from the scene and that we was in the truck. So they didn't even pursue the other leads that they had. And they had good leads from good witnesses that got a good view of what happened, and they didn't follow up on it.
Larice, the state later offered you a settlement of $5 million. Do you think there's a price for the amount of your life that the state took away?
Oh, no, it's no price. Because, like, I mean, we missed some of our best years. Like, this happened, I was 16 years old. So like, they took my late teens, all my 20s, and most of my 30s. So it came a time when we was actually going to trial with East Cleveland, and the judge asked us, did we have a number that we wanted to throw out there to see if they would accept? But and my answer was, how do you put a number on that? Like, there's no amount of money that can make up for what we lost. So that wasn't even. And then with East Cleveland, I don't know if you're aware of how the situation with East Cleveland, but East Cleveland has no money. So I don't even know if we would actually ever even see the $5 million that East Cleveland owes us.
Ricky, you talked about how you didn't really get to know the 18-year-old version of yourself because all of your life's hopes and dreams had to change when you were sent to prison. So I'd like to, if you can, tell us about that transition in prison and the person that you became while you were in there. What was life like behind bars?
Well, it was tough, you know. You go from one instance to planning your life, you know, because my desire was, you know, to get, when I got discharged from the Marine Corps, to get out, rehab my back, and re-enlist. I wanted to see the world through the Marine Corps, you know. To go from that extreme to your whole life flashing before your eyes, you find yourself sitting in a little shoebox of a cell called Death Row, and it's just hard to wrap your mind around the concept, you know, and I'm not going to say innocent, but naive 18-year-old kid was gone. He had to, in order to survive in that environment. That guy couldn't have survived in there. I had to become somebody else. And there was a lot of rage and anger in me because mostly not so much as what had happened, but I didn't know why it happened. And that was the most frustrating thing. Like, why me? Why us? You know we didn't do this. They know we didn't do this, you know? And I had to become this person initially that I thought I had to survive that environment, you know?
And Laurie, same question for you. How did you cope when you were sent to prison so young?
Laurie? It's kind of like what Ricky said. It's like, I mean, you got to just adjust to the new environment. And like, I was scared to be an understatement because I was so young, so I didn't even know what I was going into. And you just got to change up everything. And one thing that like I'm still dealing with now since I'm free is like the kind of showing emotion, because in there, like when you show emotion when you're in prison, it's a sign of weakness.
Exactly.
So you have to just turn that switch off. And I kind of battle that still, like, since I'm free, because, like my girlfriend, she want me to be more affectionate and different things like that. And I had to explain to her, like, you know, when I was in there, I had to turn that switch off. And it was hard to do because, you know, I was a kid. Like, I never know I would not be able to show emotion. But in there, I had to do that. So now that I'm free, I can't just hit that switch and turn it back on. I was so used to not showing emotion. So,
right. That becomes like an automatic response.
Yeah. So that's like a big thing with me. And she like, well, you know, you don't cuddle or you don't tell me you love me all the time. But I was so used to not doing that. So I don't know how to just hit the switch and turn it back on.
And the two of you are now free because of the work of the Ohio Innocence Project. Mark Godsey, the director of that program, is here with us. We're going to talk about that program and the work that went into freeing these two individuals in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Blind Injustice is a new show opening at Cincinnati Opera, telling the real-life stories of six people freed from prison by the work of the Ohio Innocence Project. And joining Cincinnati Edition today are Ohio Innocence Project Director and UC Law Professor Mark Godsey and two of the people now free from incarceration and whose lives are part of this new opera. Laurice Glover is one of three men convicted of a murder in 1995, only to have that conviction thrown out 4 years ago. And Ricky Jackson spent 39 years in prison. That's a U.S. record for the longest served sentence by a person who was later exonerated. They're both on the phone with us. And let's go to Mark now. How did these particular cases catch the attention of the Ohio Innocence Project?
Well, we, I think since we started in 2003, have had about 10,000 inmates write us. So it's a complicated process going through and trying to pick which cases we should spend the most time on, and there's only limited resources. But with Ricky's case, for example, the impetus was Ed Vernon, the witness against him at trial, the 12-year-old boy, was now in his 50s and recanted to his pastor and said he had lived with this lie all these years and it just basically ruined his life and he wanted to come clean and set the record free. And so we began working on the case to determine how credible that was. And recantation cases are hard to win, but we had a lot of additional investigation that proved that Ed Vernon was lying and that Ricky and his co-defendants were actually innocent. With Larissa's case, it was he was convicted on gunshot residue evidence, which was later determined to be junk science and very unreliable, and a witness who recanted. But then there was pretty egregious what we call Brady violations, where there was evidence showing that somebody else did it, that the police just swept under the rug. And so once we were able to get those records, we realized this is a huge miscarriage of justice. So most people in this position that write to us, frankly, don't have that kind of luck. They don't get the break in their case, but both of these were able to find solid evidence of innocence.
So with the limited resources that you do have, how do you deploy them to work on these types of cases?
We have 20 law students at any given time who are working on the cases. We have, I think, six attorneys now who are working. And so it's really diving into the letters and the applications from the inmates and starting to do investigations. And it's sort of like a conveyor belt. Like every file goes on the conveyor belt, but some of them start falling off because for various reasons it's obvious the person's guilty or the witnesses are all dead. There's nothing that we can really do with the case. But after a certain amount of time of working on a case, some of them you start saying, oh my gosh, everything this guy's saying is turning out to be true. And look at all this other evidence. And you know, eventually you just say, this is when we've got to take back to court.
And now some of these cases, four of the cases involving six different people, are inspiring this opera, Blind Injustice, that premieres later this month, next door here at Music Hall for the Cincinnati Opera. How did this come about?
Well, it's actually kind of a lot of things in life by accident, sort of a strange occurrence that we have a YP, a young professional committee, that puts on events and awareness and things like that. And one of our members, Carrie Wade, is married to someone who is in YPCC, Young Professionals Choral Collective. And the two of them decided, like, let's get our two groups together and have a happy hour. And so we were planning that, and the director of YPCC, Kellyanne Nelson, started learning about the Innocence Project. And she thought, these are incredible stories. Maybe we can do something more than a happy hour. And she also had connections to the opera. And so she sort of presented this idea. Marcus Kukle, who was the director of new works at the opera at that time, contacted me and said, like, do you have anything that sort of summarizes this issue and your cases and your work? And I had just finished my book, Blind Injustice, and I sent him a copy of it. And then a few weeks later, I get an email from him like, this is unbelievable material for a musical, for an opera, and we'd like to create this story. Do you want to work with us on this based on your book and these cases? And I was like, yeah, I agree with you. These people like Ricky Jackson and Larice and Nancy Smith and Clarence Elkins, who are depicted in the opera, are the type of characters that, you know, opera writers try to dream up in fiction, but they're real flesh and blood people who have gone through these, you know, tragedies, but have come out on top. And so they're just perfect fodder for this type of thing, I think.
What was it like for you moving from law professor and author of this book about these cases, Blind Injustice, to working in this creative realm?
It was fascinating to see the process and working with librettist David Cote and composer Scott Davenport Richards. Frankly, like, I've just been incredibly impressed at the ability of first David to sort of take all this information, these complicated cases, complicated concepts from the book, and distill it into this script. It really is a skill that's hard for me to wrap my mind around because he does such a good job with it. And then the songs were coming in from Davenport, Richards, the composer, on a rolling basis. And so every time a new song would pop up in my SoundCloud app, I would put on headphones and listen to it. And I would just think, you know, this is really amazing. And awareness is so important to what we're doing. And I've realized that art is a very special and important way to sort of spread the message because, you know, we can make our arguments in court, we can file our legal briefs, but the public doesn't really see that. And so these stories are being now told publicly, but when you put something like a story to music, you know, for some reason, music always enhances the emotion. I mean, that's why we all love music and listen to music. And so it just brings it out at a totally different level. So I'm really excited that we're able to inform the public and educate in this particular format.
Blind Injustice has its world premiere on July 22nd and plays the 23rd, 24th, and 26th at 7:30 and on July 27th at 3 p.m. at Music Hall's Wilkes Studio. But Music Hall's announced Blind Injustice has reached capacity. Tickets are not available. Mark, you told me there's a preview on Wednesday at Allen Temple, a place with 1,100 seats. That's also sold out. So people are very curious about this tale.
Yeah.
And Ricky and Larissa, I want to turn to you. I'll start with Ricky. Have you seen or heard any of this opera yet?
Well, we had the honor of going down to witness a few rehearsals. We met some of the staff, some of the players, and so we had a brief glimpse of what's to come.
And Larissa, what did you think of the way the situation that you endured is portrayed?
Well, I thought it was great. I couldn't picture how they was going to put this together like this, to put our stories in the opera, and but it was amazing. The first opera I ever saw was the Pink Floyd opera. So I didn't understand how they was going to put our stories into the form of an opera, but it was great. I'm excited for opening night to come.
There aren't many people who have the experience that the two of you have, spending so many years locked up behind bars on false convictions, to later be freed, and then to have your story told in this creative way. It's obviously exciting people. These things are sold out. I want to talk about when the two of you realized that you may get a new shot at freedom. Ricky, what was happening when you learned that the Ohio Innocence Project was looking at digging into your story?
Well, you know, you have to maintain that you have a level of optimism, you know. I always like to say, you know, stay even keel, you know. I didn't want to get too excited, you know, but I just didn't want to just blow it off as just a, you know, a whatever opportunity. But, you know, I was giddy. I was excited. And, you know, as the months passed, and, you know, and things got more and more interesting, you know, I allowed myself, you know, to really, like, hope, you know, that, you know, this could finally be the moment I've been, you know, surviving all these years for, you know.
And what about you, Larissa, when you got the news that this organization was looking into your case?
It was kind of like mixed emotions, like just the name, Ohio Innocence Project. After going through what we went through, you see these kind of organizations free so many people. But then on the flip side of it, like being in the court system, caught up for all those years and getting so many different motions that you file and deny, I kind of had like mixed emotions with it. I was thinking positive, but then on the flip side, I was getting let down so much, so I was scared to get my hopes up.
Larissa, did you ever lose hope entirely, or did you always have at least some?
Majority of it, always did have hope, but it became a time in 2011. I had went to solitary confinement for some stuff that I didn't do, and like I'm already in prison for something I didn't do. So I was 9 months from going up for parole for my second time, And then our case was in the Supreme Court. We got denied by the Supreme Court. And then we had a co-counsel working on our case along with the Ohio Innocence Project, a law firm called Jones Day. So while I'm in the hole, we get denied by the Supreme Court. And then Jones Day sent us out a letter saying there's nothing else they can do. So they was getting off the case. And I don't know, it was like, it's like my spirit was like shattered at that time. And I started getting letters from a cousin that I have that stayed in Columbus, Ohio. And I hadn't heard from her like my whole time being incarcerated. And she just reached out to me at that time. And, you know, she wanted to see how I was doing. And I explained to her like what was going on with me at the time. So she just sent me like all of these different Bible scriptures for me to read. And she was coming to visit me in the hole. And it kind of just boosted my, it just gave me my hope back, and it kind of put me back on track. So I almost was like broken at that time, and she just came to my life at the right time, and it helped me get back on track. So during that little brief stint that I was in the hole, yeah, I almost like my spirit was like almost broken.
What about you, Ricky? You were in there for almost 40 years.
I mean, I've been to the edge a lot, you know. I mean, anybody in that situation, you know, sometimes you wonder, like, what's the point of keep going on, you know? I mean, like Reese just said, you know, all this stuff hitting him at one time like that, you know, and it's just like it was written for you. This is your fate. This is it for you, you know, and I think we've all been to the abyss and looked down, you know, but, you know, I think that, you know, we all had that little ember, that spark, you know, when we got to those points. And like his aunt reaching out to him, it's something that always pulls you back. And for me, it was just the fact, you know, when I got like that, I would get mad at myself because I'm not in the wrong. They are, you know, they are. And you have to be here. You have to survive. You have to get through this to prove that, to prove it to the world, you know. And so, like, you know, like I said, we've all had those moments, you know.
Ricky Jackson and Larice Glover, now freed from prison. So happy to hear you guys are adjusting as best you can and seem to be in good spirits. I really appreciate you both taking some time to talk to us today.
Thank you for having me, Mike. Appreciate it.
And Mark Godsey from the Ohio Innocence Project will also note that the cases of Nancy Smith, a bus driver from Cleveland, who was convicted of molesting children, and Clarence Elkins, convicted of killing his mother-in-law and raping her granddaughter wrongfully, also portrayed in this. Appreciate you being here as well, Mark.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at wvxu.org.